we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Welcome, everyone. This is Dr. Harvey Risch, Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. Today, we're continuing our new weekly series with various smart and interesting people. Our discussions are generally on science and COVID topics, but whatever our conversations might lead, they might lead. And if listeners have questions for me, please submit them at americaoutloud.com/pulse, P-U-L-S-E. I'm pleased to introduce today's guest, Mr. Edward Dowd, who is a hedge fund guru and former equity portfolio manager for BlackRock Capital. He's also just released his new book, Cause Unknown, that's investigating the epidemic of sudden death that has occurred over the last 2 years. Well, I think the correct cause of them is not unknown, but actually coincidence. And he has appeared extensively in media to discuss a large-scale excess all-cause mortality starting in the latter half of 2021. So, Ed, let's go ahead. What's been on your mind lately?
Well, you know, I've been going on a lot of media lately talking about the book, and it's been timely, I guess, because of the DeMar Hamlin Monday Night Football situation. And, you know, the book has a lot of sudden athletic deaths links to stories. We don't comment on them. We just link sudden athletic deaths so people can view what's going on. And, you know, look, you're a scientist. You study data. And, you know, the sudden athletic deaths are anecdotal. There is a study that was done, the Lausanne study in 2006, that tried to document as best they could over 38 years sudden athletic deaths globally. And they came up with 1,101 over 38 years. That averages 29 a year. And so sudden athletic deaths have happened in the past. And as a Wall Street person and as a guy that studies frequency, velocity, rate of change, something happened in 21. And we'd be lucky to have a month with just 29 sudden athletic deaths. So is something going on? Yes. Yeah. So you intuitively and through just discernment, a lot of people in their gut know something has changed. And then in my book, I go extensively into the metadata. And the punchline from the book is essentially this: the employed of the United States of America have had worse health outcomes than the general U.S. population, which isn't supposed to happen because the very nature of the employed population is they're healthier because they're getting up every morning and going to work. And what we found in two data sets quickly was just group life policyholders, which is a very small subset of the United States population. They work at Fortune 500 and mid-sized companies. They experienced 40% mortality in 21 versus the general population of 32%. That relationship flipped. It's never happened before. Then in the disability data, we saw a 3 standard deviation event starting in February of 21, where the year-over-year rate of change was 3 sigma. You know, as you know, that's 0.03% at the time. And that's what we call a trend change. And we rose from around 29 to 30 million that had been the previous number for the prior 4 or 5 years to 33.2 million in September. Half of those are employed. The employment disability rate's up 31% since February 21, while the general U.S. population is up 9. So those two facts alone suggest to me that something happened to the employed population of our country. And if you ask this question, what changed? Well, in my mind, only two things changed: a mass vaccination program and job mandates. And, you know, when you were there, when I was in Washington, D.C. with Senator Johnson, I told Senator Johnson it's a national security issue. So that's my stance. And what's going on now is a cover up at this point, because the data I see, clearly the authorities see. And I'm befuddled as to why nothing's being done to stop this program. Lately, before you can ask a question, I just want to let you know we're working on my team at Finance Technologies, like a lot of these guys that help me with the analysis. We're working on a new study. We're looking at the clinical trial data from both Pfizer and Moderna. There's not a lot of data, but they do report adverse events, and we're trying to link them to the real world disabilities. We have to make a lot of assumptions, so it's going to be controversial, but we hope to get that report out maybe this weekend or next week. And it'll be interesting, and hopefully it'll generate some conversation. And we're just trying to link what we're seeing in the real world to the clinical trials. And of course, as you know, Their definition of what an adverse event is very narrow, so it's going to be controversial what we do. So we'll talk about that when it comes.
Well, we've had a whole history of denialism of adverse events from medical, everything from drugs, from procedures, from choices of plans, that doctors have a very hard time admitting that something didn't work because of a bad choice that they were part of. And there are times when a good doctor will say, okay, this didn't work. Well, let's try something else. Medicine isn't perfect. We try our best, but sometimes things don't work. But there are also times when there's nothing else to offer because the doctor doesn't know any better and thinks I have nothing else to offer and instead should be referring to another doctor who has potentially alternative approaches. But inherent in medicine as a whole and in the guidance of medicine coming from the federal government agencies is the complete denial of adverse events in any formalized way. So the fact that there's an FAERS and a VAERS databases looking at drugs and vaccines, respectively, trying to catalog these numbers by self-report, virtual self-report, is a way that the government could say, look, we did something, we threw money at it, and well, what do those things show? Well, you can't draw any conclusions from them. We say explicitly that there's no objective information in these databases. They're only for signals. Well, what's a signal? Well, we can't exactly tell you what a signal is when we recognize one. And so it's kind of like they put it out with one arm and take it away with the other and think that they're getting away with not actually divulging the reality of all of the adverse events that have gone on, that is part of medicine, but way larger in the last few years, perhaps, than we are used to experiencing. You have to realize that, for example, FDA puts its approval each year on some 10,000 drugs and devices, but it also withdraws its approval on 300 or 400 every year. So that means for 300 or 400 drugs and devices every year that FDA has approved, it approved them wrongly. It was in error. And it's admitted to that by quietly removing, withdrawing the approvals. It puts a little notice somewhere out on some website, and doctors know that they're not supposed to be using it anymore. And that's about it. And these things don't hit public knowledge because they're usually esoteric drugs for narrow ranges of treatment and things like that. So there is, I think, the gaslighting problem is huge. And it was already huge before we got to COVID, and now it just ramped up orders of magnitude worse. And this is just a protective mechanism for government to pretend that it's doing the right thing, it's doing the good thing, independent of the realities of the evidence that are out there, the data that are out there. And your work has been tremendous in bringing to light some of the realities of the data, even if they're going to assert that all these changes in mortality were just coincidence. If every death is a coincidence, then the wholesale death is another big coincidence, right? How do you know? Maybe there was some bias and something else happened. Maybe the sun aligned in some different, solar spots, whatever flare pattern, and that's what caused the excess mortality. Or climate change, or you name it. Political circumstances in Brazil cause us to be more anxious. You can make up things ad lib, ad nauseum for the reasons, and they don't have any currency, but something that's plausible, has a lot more currency, even if it's not proof. And the main thing that's bothered me about all this is there's been a systematic lack of investigation into things the government didn't want us to find or know about. And this goes to the suppression of studies of early treatment, not just the suppression of early treatment, but the suppression of studies of early treatment that the government essentially closed down, continues to close down. Dr. Sabine Hazan has been doing a randomized trial of early treatment. The FDA locked it up. Fortunately, she had already enrolled enough patients to do what she needed to do. But the FDA came in, said, you're doing unsafe testing. with no evidence. They have no evidence of that fact, but they asserted it anyway, and they locked up the study so she can only continue to monitor the subjects. She can't enroll any new ones. This is a massive interference in the knowledge base to protect what it's protecting. And so there are no studies of the mortality that you're seeing. There are no formal studies carried out with the government. There are no formal studies of all the different things that we don't know about, all the autopsies that should have been done and haven't been done. You know, it is a major, it's the next ramp up from gaslighting is suppression of studies to find the information that, that you're being gaslighted over.
You know, Harvey, what's interesting about what you just said, this is the problem. So there's two things that happened. Suppression of knowledge base, which you just referred to, with the simultaneous, what we're learning was a military grade PSYOP. And now the evidence is starting to come to light. There's still a lot of suppression. But what I find the biggest problem, and I saw this in the financial markets all the time, and my ethics professor in business school said this, you can't rationalize facts to someone whose position is based on emotion. And a lot of people, including those in the government and doctors, good doctors, they emotionally made a decision and they're having a tough time letting go of that decision because a lot of time was based on ego. And I saw this in the financial markets all the time. Why do smart people ride stocks down to zero when the fraud starts to become apparent? Because their ego is invested. And I would often hear things from my peers. Well, Ed, I talked to the CEO and he told me blah, blah, blah. And of course, the CEO of Enron went to jail. So you're appealing to an authority figure that's lying to you. So this is the dilemma I think is most startling to me and really concerns me is it's coming to light that there's a lot of problems with these vaccines, but there's because of the military grade PSYOP and the inability for the government and the media to really highlight this, we still continue to roll along with a lot of people in denial, and it makes me sad.
So why is there this big PSYOP? What is being protected?
I have no idea. I mean, that's above my pay grade, but it's been coming out through the Twitter files and discovery that there was definitely a plan to get people to take the vaccine. And it worked well, apparently, because a lot of people did. A lot of us didn't. But, it was if you go back to 21, there was a lot of pressure put on all of us by even loved ones. And I've never seen anything quite like it in my life.
Well, right. I think, back in mid 2020, when all these big lies were coming out about early treatment, I said, we're in Germany, 1934, 1935, when the government is making big lies out there that are easily disprovable, but you're not allowed to think the thought of disproving it, because of social fears, career fears, and things like that. This is the big lie totalitarianism that made me start to wonder when I realized how systematic it was, whether this was inherent in our government altogether or whether this was a pathology just now in COVID. And I start to worry that this has actually been going on for a way longer time, but on things that just didn't affect me personally or intellectually,
I agree. I think the seeds of what we've seen in this mass vaccination campaign have been there for a while. And again, it wasn't, I was like you, I knew things were corrupt and bad, but I was called to action when I was, when it became apparent to me that in order to operate in the world, I had to get jabbed. And that was a bridge too far for me. And that's when I became activated. And I do feel like institutions have been captured by, moneyed interests and what I call the institutional imperative, which is where institutions, well, it started down Wall Street. Corporations have management teams. They're supposed to act in the best interest of the shareholders. Well, eventually they become corrupted and act in their own best interests. And you can apply that principle to government institutions as well. You're no longer serving the public, you're serving yourself. And I think that's been going on throughout all of our institutions for years. We just didn't see it until now.
So I've always had this idealistic idea that governments are supposed to lie to the people in order to protect them. And that doesn't mean that they do this paternalistic, you must be vaccinated kind of stuff. It means that we have inside knowledge of what's going on in China. And so we have to tell you something else in order that we can defeat China or whatever it is, the external agent that's threatening us. But when that changes so that the lies become protecting their jobs rather than protecting the people, that's the pathology that I'm thinking of. That the checks and balance, that's when checks and balances have to come into effect. And public health should never have this paternalistic lying in the first place. And in fact, if you go back to the most recent kind of definitive aspects of respiratory viruses in public health, there was an article by Tom Inglesby in 2006, I believe, co-authored by Don Henderson, who was responsible for eradicating smallpox and the authority of public health. And they said population lockdowns should never be tried, and all of these things that were completely opposite to everything we did in the pandemic. So the Public Health Administration knew what the proper approach is for managing a respiratory pandemic, and they did the exact opposite. They violated, and Inglesby himself switched sides and violated exactly what they had written at a time of knowledge when there were no corporate interests bearing on, to a large degree, bearing on the influenza epidemic, the annual waves of influenza, because the vaccines were already out there and people were using them. It was a known product. There wasn't that much harm that we know of coming from them, and it was steady state. So there wasn't anything, to have to protect out of the ordinary, as opposed to, H5N1 or swine flu or whatever, that those things that we started to get propagandized against, but they never went anywhere, and they couldn't maintain the propaganda. But now
Right.
we do.
Quick question. Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't there a SARS-CoV-1 where we didn't do anything basically and it burned itself out?
Yes.
And then we have SARS-CoV-2 and we did the exact opposite of what we did in SARS-CoV-1, and this is where we are today. It's kind of like we did exactly what you're not supposed to do.
Well, so yes and no. Don't forget that SARS-CoV-2 did go worldwide pandemic before the vaccines came out.
Okay.
Okay. So they're intrinsically different organisms in their reproduction rate and their transmissibility. And so it's not a surprise that SARS-CoV-2 did what it did. It's just that our vac major non-sterilizing vaccine program generated more mutants, more substrains than likely would have occurred in nature, and how well we would have controlled it is now a hypothetical without the vaccines. And it would have become endemic anyway, but the question is, would it have mutated to Omicron or not? So let me just take a pause here. We're getting to the end of our segment, so we'll be right back after a commercial break. So everybody, please stay tuned.
We are fighting the ultimate fight between good and evil. AmericaOutloud.com replaces groupthink with innovative think. Well, it was Walt Whitman, the poet, who said, "Keep your face always toward the sunshine, and shadows will fall behind you." America Out Loud Talk Radio, liberty and justice for all.
You already know Genesis plus HOCL is your best defense against viruses. But did you also know it's the most powerful weapon for eliminating airborne mold too? Customers are raving about the Genesis Fogger's ability to tackle mold problems and the bad smells that go with them. And we all know mold is a hazard to your health. There's no airborne invader that Genesis can't handle. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud to receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you're ready for anything.
We wouldn't go a day without washing our hands, brushing our teeth, and washing our nose. Well, wait, we wash our nose? Yes, the number one place where bacteria, viruses, and pollen enter the body is through the nose. So the average person breathes over 23,000 times a day. That's 23,000 opportunities for bacteria, viruses, and irritants to get into your nose and make you sick. For an extra layer of protection, wash your nose with Clear. That is Clear, X-L-E-A-R. Clear's drug-free nasal spray features xylitol, an ingredient proven to block adhesion of many nasty bacteria and viruses, and effectively clean, not just rinse like a saline, but wash your nose. Clear nasal spray quickly alleviates congestion, opens your airway, and ensures your body's natural defenses are strong. Read the research studies for yourself at clear.com. That's X-L-E-A-R.com. Protect yourself from the pathogens and junk you breathe. Pick up a bottle for you and your family today.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Dr. Harvey Risch with Mr. Ed Dowd. We were just talking about whether SARS-CoV-2, the virus that we have now, is more infective than SARS-CoV-1 and our response to this pandemic as opposed to the pandemic from the predecessor virus that never actually manifested as a pandemic. And my observation about this was that had we not gone the vaccine route, had we used early outpatient treatment and saved maybe 300, 500,000 lives from doing that, the virus still would have become endemic, but we don't know whether it would have eventually mutated to an Omicron-like virus or not. And that really is the critical question about why we're now approaching the end of the pandemic, as grudgingly as the federal government is admitting it, that Omicron is by and large a much, much milder illness and doesn't get deep into the lungs and doesn't generate the same degree of lethal pneumonia that the original strains of SARS-CoV-2 did. And so essentially we lucked out in having a virus become its own vaccine, its own respiratory vaccine, largely for the great majority of people who get it. And I don't know whether that would have happened had we treated it. I think that this is called Mueller's ratchet, that viruses get into a population in a state where they're not optimal for the niche that they have. And the reason we have so many viruses that do the same respiratory infections is because the signs and symptoms of a respiratory infection is what spreads the virus the best for the ones that get into the nose and throat and lungs. And so the virus wants to get out as best it can. And if it makes you so sick that you stay home, it's not going to do that. It's going to infect your household, but it's not going to get out to hundreds of people around you. And so viruses want you to be sick in order to cough and sneeze to get the virus out, but they don't want you to be so sick that you stay home. And so that's the niche. It's the niche that determines the ultimate virus properties. And that niche is what makes the viruses basically mild, unpleasant, aggravating, annoying, but medically speaking, mild. And fortunately for us, we got to Omicron that way, you know, after a certain amount of time. That was a difficult time to get through. But the Omicron era has been a much easier thing. And it's also engendered the fact that the vaccines have stopped working because COVID is not seasonal. As much as we had two seasons in winter, we've had five waves of COVID, only two of which were in winter. And it's still adapting to its habitat, its human habitat. And whether it turns out to be seasonal in the future is possible. But as of now, there's not been a major winter wave in the United States. There's been a little bit of a rise and a steady state, but it's not been a wave of a new variant that comes along and captures the population like it's done in, you know, like flu does or other respiratory viruses do in the fall when kids go back to school and they transmit it and adults get it and they transmit it and people, you know, are staying inside more. That has just not happened this year with Omicron anywhere near as much as the previous strains have. This is why it's basically endemic and why it's not serious for almost everybody. And that it's something we take in stride. We should be taking this in stride. Its seriousness is at the level of flu now or other respiratory viruses. And we don't make a big deal. We don't, you know, get all anxious about, even though, you know, we as a society, we take 30 or 40,000 deaths per year from flu, you know, in stride. And we'd like to make it lower, but we don't collapse our civilization because there's 30, 40,000 flu deaths like we did for COVID.
Correct. I can attest to your seasonality statement. I got my first bout of COVID Omicron July 4th of last year at a barbecue where 90% of the people were vaccinated.
Right. And how many have you had it since then?
No, I have not.
Okay. So, and I had it in September which is before, early September, before kids went back to school and so on. I mean, it's just endemic in human existence, and one has to cope with it. And the immunity from it, in unvaccinated people who get Omicron, the immunity looks to be good for a year at least, for most people. How long that lasts, after that, we don't know. It's certainly much, much better than vaccine immunity, which is only a few months at best.
Right.
But the problem with not being seasonal is that we don't have Australia 6 months out of phase.
Right.
Where we don't know what strains are coming 6 months in advance. And we cannot turn around a vaccine in 2 months or 1 month from knowing what's taking over the population to coming out with an effective vaccine. Excuse me, even if vaccines are safe, we can't do that. So right. By the time the vaccines have come out, they're ineffectual. And that's the current problem as well.
And they don't seem, the drug makers, the FDA and the government, they don't seem to care about that little fact you just mentioned.
Well, right. Why are we still seeing ads to get the bivalent booster, and get your kids boosted and so on? It's ridiculous. I think the population now is seeing through a lot of this.
Yes, hopefully. So you mentioned to me earlier about ICD codes. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Okay. As we know, the WHO suggested capturing vaccination status for COVID. And Medicare and Medicaid developed the codes to put into the ICD system. So the ICD system, International Classification of Disease, are codes that insurance companies and government agencies use to classify both disease states and hazardous exposures. And so when you break your arm or something like that, you go to the doctor and he puts it in a cast, that generates ICD codes that go to the insurers so they know what to pay to whom and so on. So, and if you have procedures done, that generates other ICD codes. And so all of this is part of the management system for the medical care. And it's used not just in the United States, it's used in Canada in their socialized medicine, not just in us in our anti-socialized medicine. And so this new code for COVID is two codes, one designating not vaccinated for COVID, and a second one designated partially vaccinated for COVID, where partial has the meaning of at the time the physician, the healthcare person, gets the information about vaccine status, the vaccination that the person had doesn't comply with whatever the CDC says is fully vaccinated at that time point. So there are only these two codes. There's no codes for other things, like there's no code for fully vaccinated. There's no code for refused vaccination information. There's no code for unknown vaccine information. Now, those things could all be fixed. They could all be entered into with just adding another digit to the codes to make them knowledgeable information. But my problem is that the whole discussion that went on with the insurance company representatives about generating these codes all discussed having non-vaccinated and partially vaccinated codes under the guise, in their thinking, of that being non or partially vaccinated was a hazardous exposure. That there's no reason to have a code for something that has no bearing on your health. Okay, only if it provides a hazardous exposure. So they're obviously thinking, we don't need a code for fully vaccinated because fully vaccinated is good. That's not hazardous. That's what they're thinking. And this proves that there is a nefarious component to encoding this information, because there's no reason to have to code things that have no real bearing on your medical care, except to disallow or distinguish people who are not compliant with whatever the government's narrative is. The government narrative still is that the vaccines are safe and effective. They're still in major denial that all the adverse events that happen, those are so rare, we don't have to pay attention to them. And so they're portraying the lack of a code for fully vaccinated is that's not hazardous. Being unvaccinated, that's hazardous, so we have to have a code for it. And the problem with this is that these codes are extremely stigmatizing, that because of what could happen to people who are officially found not to be vaccinated, meaning they lose their job. That's happened over the last year, year and a half. Or they could lose access to their bank account. They could lose, if this information is released to the general business entities out in, you know, in everyday life, if it's they could face some kind of legal interference. If it's released to the FDA, I mean the FBI, they could face tax-based consequences if it's leaked to IRS. This is a very stigmatizing piece of information that conveys no benefit, and especially so since the CDC on August 11th of last year said that the vaccines don't work for public health management. They said that the two-dose regimen provides minuscule benefit, and boosters provide transient benefit that wanes. And in public health, something that's transient and wanes is not a policy that one ever uses. You need sustained benefit for something in order to have a policy. So the CDC basically said that the vaccines are not tools for public health management of the pandemic. And then they later on said that we have no reason to distinguish between vaccinated and unvaccinated people for any policies from the CDC at this point. And they implied this in the August 11th website information, that nothing there on the webpage distinguished between vaccinated, unvaccinated people on policies of whether you should mask or shouldn't mask, whether you should get tested or not tested. All these things had no differentiation between vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals. And then they formally came out and said this for healthcare workers on September 23rd. So if the CDC, our government entity, is saying that there is no difference in policy between vaccinated and unvaccinated people, what's the point of capturing this information in insurance databases? There's no government interest to capture it because there is no policy that would distinguish such people.
I agree with you. And you know, to your, all of the points you just made that it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. So we answer our own question. There's a nefarious intent by the very nature that we don't have any reason to know this other than use it to discriminate, in my opinion, or shift behaviors, or you know, whatever they're going to use it for, it's a tool. It's not helping people from a policy standpoint.
Well, if you look at it from the insurance company perspective, they want to be able to know how much they pay for which different kinds of events that happen in people's medical lives. And they want to be able to predict things. And so they want to do basically public health descriptive analyses of how many vaccinated people get these outcomes, how many unvaccinated people get those outcomes. They want to be able to do that. And that's a valid thing to do because they do that day in, day out with everything else that they analyze about people's exposures and outcomes and medical care and so on. So that's right. A valid thing to do. The problem is that we don't trust the government and we don't trust the entities that have access to the individual data to limit what they do to that, because the government has lied to us for 2 years. It said the vaccines were safe and effective for a year and a half or 2 years. It's lied about early treatment. It's lied about the efficacy of masks and social distancing and lockdowns and everything. It's lied about virtually everything policy-wise. And so why would we trust such a lying entity to somehow tell us, you can trust us, we're the government, we'll protect your potentially stigmatizing information. You know, no, we won't do anything bad with it. Why would we trust them in the first place?
You just answered your own question. We shouldn't, and we need to somehow figure out how to stop this. I have a question for you, Dr. Harvey. You know, you've been on this journey for a while, and you had a lot of peers and colleagues that probably, you know, shunned you. Where are we with some of our peers? I have people that shun me too, but they're reaching out to me now. Do you feel that the lies are breaking down, and people who are entrenched in their old positions are starting to at least acknowledge that something may have gone terribly wrong here? What's your sense as to where we are in this journey?
Well, yes, I quickly learned who my friends were, two of them that were left. And I made a whole bunch of new friends, which is totally amazing. And I think that what you learn from this is that intellectual people can be common sense morons.
Right.
That for whatever psychological reasons, people with lots of intellectual theoretical knowledge hang on the theories rather than what their real world common sense experience tells them. And, you know, and I think the more intellectual a person is, the more we tend to do that. And it takes a lot of kind of an empirical drive in life to be able to put your easy to digest plausible theories aside for the moment and test them with some real world experience to see how well they actually work. You know, and that's the reason I'm an epidemiologist, because I love the basic science, I love the lab theories, and I love all the pathways that I do in the cancer research, but I don't believe any of them. I test them human data, I do human studies in order to see what whether something is really true or not. Lab
right.
stuff and animal stuff is interesting, but it's just not compelling until the human data prove that it applied to humans.
Nassim Taleb is a intellectual who's in the financial community. He identifies what the people you just described as IYI, intellectual yet idiots. And, you know, and when I was on Wall Street, I had the same phenomenon. There were people who were super academic, super smart, but they relied on theories. And when evidence started to present itself, they just couldn't see it for whatever reason. And my whole career was built upon making money from these people. taking the other side of the trade, so to
That's
speak.
That's outstanding, right? I mean, you know, don't believe your lying eyes is the
correct.
Correct. That you the empirical data are definitive as long as they make sense in some way and they're not random, and that's what we have to deal with in real life, and that's what we do as epidemiologists all the time is distinguishing between systematic and random data. You know, and when we do studies in order to gather large amounts of systematic data, and so we can average out and rule out the random part, and what remains is the systematic relationships that are what we study.
How are we doing on time for this segment?
Oh, so right, we're about at the end of this segment, so we're approaching our break time again. So we'll be back shortly, and please stay tuned.
These days, every time you turn on the news, it seems like there's a new threat to your health. Maintaining a strong immune system has never been more critical. Advanced nutrition company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost to help you strengthen your immunity. Unlike other supplements that don't work, Immune Super Boost is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra absorption of science-backed nutrients proven to support immunity, like vitamin C, D3, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea. These physician-formulated gels come in a small gel pack. Tear off the top and shoot it down, or mix it in water. Boost your immunity. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. Risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD.
For 40 years, alarmists have been warning of a climate catastrophe, yet none of their dire predictions have come true. Temperatures have not soared, sea level rise has not been unusual, and extreme weather events have not increased in either frequency or intensity. In short, there is no climate emergency. For 15 years, the International Climate Science Coalition has led the call for climate realism and a Made in America climate plan. A plan based on real science that responds to the real-world needs of Americans, supports economic growth, and strengthens our essential infrastructure. A plan that protects the environment and ensures that Americans can enjoy the blessings of clean air, clean land, and clean water for generations to come. It's time to put ideology and pseudoscience aside. It's time for a sensible climate plan. For more information or to donate, visit our website, icsc-climate.com.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Dr. Harvey Risch with Mr. Ed Dowd. So you were just asking to ask me a new question, I think.
Yeah, so I just wanted to let you know that, we're in the midst, I call this a prod in progress, and things get constantly updated. The good news is that Bloomberg put out an article this week. So we've got them to admit, before there was a lack of even acknowledgement that there were excess deaths amongst young people. That was not being acknowledged. This week, Bloomberg said, yes, young people are dying, but it's not the vaccines. So that's progress. Progress, right?
Yes.
So we're at least getting the authorities to admit there is a problem. That's good. That's good news, because then hopefully the conversation steers to what is it, and then that'll lead to the vaccines. From where I sit, I get constantly updated on the data. And one of the questions I want to ask you, and look at what the data I'm about to share with you is, what's your sense as to the medium term to long term effects of the vaccine? We know that there's an initial adverse event sometimes right afterwards, but what is your sense as to what's going on, the medium term to long term effects of this mass vaccination program, and how do you think that'll manifest? Will things get better or worse? And I'm monitoring the data, and I hope that it gets better, but I have some things to report after you answer my question that may suggest things are not getting better.
Okay, so let's see how close I can get. I'm just in my thinking about this. So the VAERS data and other data that we have on individuals says what the short-term adverse events are that characterize these vaccines. We don't quite know, because now Fauci is pushing for, he said in an article recently that the vaccines that we've carried out over the last 2 years don't work well. Now, that's not an admission we shouldn't be using them. It was a statement of, so we need ones with higher doses given more frequently. That was, and therefore give us $1 billion worth of funding to study more of this stuff. That was the thrust of his article. So the medium term adverse events are what you're seeing in the all-cause mortality and the non-COVID mortality that the insurance companies are reporting. The longer term things, I think we haven't quite gotten to the tip of the iceberg yet. What I think is that there is a general immune system damage that occurs from the vaccination, that it's like the vaccines are so potent that they terrorize the immune system. And so the immune system goes into shock and does certain behaviors that dysregulate how it functions normally. And I'm not an immunologist, so I can't speak to any of this in detail, except to say that if you interfere with immune surveillance, you're going to allow things that are normally kept in check to occur, like small cells that become cancerous don't get shut off and go on to become cancers. And if you overdrive the immune system in terms of inflammation, then you get inflammation in tissues, in various organs, and if they're in the testes or the ovaries, can lead to, you know, infertility and things like that. And there's also an open question as to whether these vaccines can get incorporated, the genetic information can get incorporated to the cells, the sperm and oocytes that form the next generation, the offspring of the people who are vaccinated, and are present in, therefore, in their DNA. We don't know the answer to that question yet. It's theoretically possible. We don't know the reality of that yet. In terms of the immune differential, we have the problem of cancers take different amounts of time from when they're initiated to when they come to diagnosis. The fastest ones are the blood cancers, the leukemias and lymphomas, that can take 2, 3, 4 years in our current knowledge, when whatever initiates them gets them to the point where they can be recognized by blood tests or lumps, to be simple. So those are the fastest growing ones. Then you have shorter solid tumors like lung cancer that takes 5 to 10 years to become manifest. And then you have a whole range of other kinds of cancers that can take longer. Colon cancer can take 40 years. Bladder cancer takes 20, 25. And pancreatic cancer takes 11 to 15. So there's different ranges of cancers, but they take a long time from whenever the immune damage that occurred that led the cells that became cancers to actually escape from immune surveillance. So the generation of new cancers is going to take a long time to figure out whether anything happened and whether there was a point source of all of this in 2021, 2022 or not.
Right.
Okay.
Well, let me tell you what I've seen recently. So,
let me just interrupt. There is one other thing, which is that cancers that are already in existence, but they're trying to grow and the immune system is trying to clobber them and their intention so that they're sitting there kind of passively not recognized. If the immune system gets weakened, then they grow. And so they come to diagnosis. So those are ones that might've been sitting around for 5 or 10 years quietly, like breast cancer, which sits around for 20 years and then recurs. Those are things that suddenly appear as solid tumors. And you think a solid tumor couldn't occur 6 months or a year after getting a vaccination because it takes 5, 10, 15 years for them to occur. But those are ones that were likely there, present, undiagnosed, that then can come to diagnosis more quickly. And so there's that possibility also.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is what I'm seeing currently in the data. So the good news is the disability data came out last Friday. And the good news is it's off from the high we put in September for the general U.S. population. It hasn't broken trend. So the second derivative rate of change is slowed, which is good, but the trend line hasn't broken. So it's still growing. I want to see that trend break. But then I looked at the employed segment of the population, and their high was in December. And their rate of change is that their slope is rising faster than the general U.S. population. And they're just slightly off their high in the month of January from December. And then I looked at women, and women, their rate of change of disabilities is the highest. The slope is the worst. And their high was in December, and they're slightly off their high. So whatever's going on with the employed population continues. The general U.S. population, we've come down slightly. So that it's good and bad news. But it also leads me to conclude that it's the vaccines because the employed were forced, for the most part, to take it, and other people had a choice.
Well, let me ask you a question. The vaccines that people took over the last year or more, 2 years, were not just given uniformly across that whole time span. There were waves of vaccination. And to the degree that you can define the narrowness of those waves, you might be able to look for consequences that have some relationship to when those waves occurred.
And my team, and it's in the disability report on our website, the Humanity Project at Finance Technologies. My team looked at, and now again, people will say correlation's not causation, but we looked at the disability increases timed with the vaccine rollout, and the fit was 0.92. Now that's an R squared. Again, people will argue that, but it's a pretty good fit. And
I would say that the argument of correlation is not causation actually has a reply, which is that when you talk about individual causation in individuals, for example, somebody who takes a drug and has an adverse event, we have a different standard in legal cases, which is remove the drug and see if it goes away and give the drug again and see if it comes back. And so if you have waves where this behavior has occurred, you've done this for the individual population as a whole, that's called de-challenge and re-challenge. And the waves have essentially done that. And that is strong evidence of that kind of causation. So it's not like it's just, oh, it's correlation, and we could just throw our hands and say it doesn't mean anything. Because that's why if you key it to waves, that's specific to de-challenge and re-challenge, which is very meaningful.
Yes. And then we're in the new report we're going to issue, we're going to look at the 2 months of the blinded study adverse event data. And we had to simulate, of course, forward the adverse rates, and we had to make a lot of assumptions on decline and what have you. And what's going on in the real world is higher than what occurred in the Pfizer and Moderna clinical trials, according to our models. But we suspect that their bias selection and who they tested, and also their definition of what an adverse event is. So, but we're going to look at a second paper and analyze that. And the early indications are that there's a fit there. So there is a fit, but it's not, the real world is worse than the simulation we ran. And we'll put that out and people can tear it apart. And I just want to start the conversation. That's all I want to do, right?
Yeah.
But the correlation between the vaccine rollout and the disabilities is a pretty good indication that something needs to be investigated, number one. Number two, one of the things that I keep going back to is the event that occurred in the third quarter of 2021. That was when the vaccine mandates hit. And I call the smoking gun the millennials because they're not supposed to have excess mortality. And their mortality, excess mortality prior to the mandates was running around 30%. And it accelerated to 84% temporally in a very short period of time. And that's the Society of Actuaries. These are the healthiest amongst us. And that event was, until someone can come up with a better reason, the event was mass vaccination and mandates at the same time. And I suspect millennials, ages 25 through 44, were vaccine hesitant because we all knew in 2021 that COVID did not affect young people. It was mostly something that affected older folks. And we knew the risk at the time, I think, was 99.8% survival rate. So right. Many millennials made the decision internally, well, I'm not going to get it. I don't need it. But then they were forced. And then we saw the excess deaths. That's kind of, that for me has been a big smoking gun that I just keep talking about. And I'm going to keep talking about. It's evidence of a crime, in my humble opinion. The other thing we're seeing, the good news is obviously because of that pull forward event, excess mortality in Society of Actuary numbers came down, and we're running now at 23% as of Q2 of 2022 in the millennials, 25 through 44. And again, I choose them because they're not supposed to die. So 23% excess mortality is a disaster still. And I have insiders who are telling me that the Society of Actuary numbers for third quarter of 2022 are going to be 23%. So it seems to be flatlining there. I'm being told that the fourth quarter numbers may accelerate. So that, as you know, on Wall Street, reacceleration is a resumption of trend. So people will say seasonality, but you just told me that this is not a seasonal disease, so that'll be a good argument.
And the mortality from it is COVID. This is all cause.
Yes, all cause.
Right.
So people argue with me and say, well, it's COVID and seasonal. Well, there is no seasonality to COVID. So that's going to be a good argument I'm going to make when people come at me. But I'm sad to say that the employed population is just barely off its highs in terms of disabilities, and it looks like millennial excess mortality, all-cause mortality, will resume potentially a slight to maybe a bigger acceleration in Q4. So that's what has me concerned about the medium-term effects.
And do you think that's coming from the boosters?
The booster uptake is way down. I'm suspecting the initial jabs are manifesting things, 9 to 12 months later. And anecdotally, on Maui with my friend group, the people who did take it are starting to manifest some problems now, and they never got boosters. So that's anecdotal, but again, studies are going to have to be done. But this is, you start with anecdotes, you start with real world evidence, you start asking questions that we're not apparently allowed to ask anymore, Harvey.
No, you don't ask what you don't want to find out the answer to.
Right. So I want to have good news for everybody, but I'm a little Larry, and I'm a little sad to report that it doesn't look like the disabilities for the employed are asserting a second derivative rate of change like the general U.S. population. And if the millennials reaccelerate, then we need to have a national conversation about this.
Yeah, I mean, the national conversation is going on in the House of Representatives, but. What I've seen in watching the discussions are one side is presenting data and observations of what happened, and the other side is just throwing terms like misinformation and disinformation and not responding and not rebutting anything. And as I've said to people, that I'm unwilling to discuss anything about the pandemic with people who scoff. If people have to be engaged and participate, and if people are only going to say, I don't believe you, and not provide something else and just say that's disinformation or that's misinformation, that is not a debate. That's
not a debate. And I get those. I do not engage with those people. on Twitter or Getter, or when I get interviewed, I've had some people who call in saying that I'm spreading misinformation, and that's not a valid argument. Right. And in many ways, saying, one of the you and I know this from our years of debating people internally. When people start with ad hominems, as far as I'm concerned, they've lost the debate. And I think when someone labels you a misinformation or disinformation person, that's an ad hominem.
Right.
And we're done. Right. We're done with debating. You've lost. That's my opinion.
Right. No, I know. It's because science speaks for itself. Scientific evidence speaks for itself. And so anybody who's censors, who is basically saying, I don't have a rebuttal, and so I don't have a tool to use to argue against your point. All I can do is censor, even by throwing words like disinformation out, you know, or saying I'm not willing to even talk to you. That's censorship, and that is admission that there is no opposite evidence.
I agree, and one of my biggest things I've said from the very beginning of this, especially during the suppression of early treatment, censorship kills, and the tech companies, I think, are accessories to murder, and I think the media is accessories to murder. And I hope legally someone goes there. I'm not a lawyer, but in my humble opinion, the censorship has killed people.
You know, I think that's the bottom line, and I think intentionality is a question. Callousness is the real underlying factor, that the parties just didn't care about how many people died, and in fact may have even thought that more people dying would scare more, another psyop to scare more people to get vaccinated. And unfortunately, that's the world we've been living in. So we're out of time, as usual, in these conversations. There's lots more we can talk about, but we'll have to call it at that point. So I hope everybody enjoyed the discussion. If you have questions for me, please submit them at americaoutloud.com/pulse. Ed, this has been really great. Thank you. Some really interesting discussions. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And please come back next week.